Hello, I'm Lauren Wolf. This is number 0423, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0423. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, is back on to talk about the end of the Cassini mission to Saturn.
The longer that a spacecraft hangs around, especially the large planets like Jupiter and Saturn, they're exposed to a lot of radiation, very extreme magnetic fields, and these can wreak havoc on the circuit boards and the electronics. So many of the times, they're hoping to rake in as much science as possible within the first few months or the first couple of years. Cassini's mission, this is like an Energizer Bunny of spacecrafts. It just kept on going and it was perfect.
Mindy Johnson is the author of Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. Many might be surprised to know about the women who worked in animation.
It is true. A lot of people are surprised, myself included, because really when you look at what we have known about animation history, it's mostly men. So it was a real joy to sort of really do some deep digging and find and make some extraordinary discoveries that women, in fact, have been there from the very beginning and have been a large part of the extraordinary world of animation, just that we've never really known that what they've done until now.
Phil Proctor, co-founder of the Fire Sign Theater and author of Where's My Fortune Cookie? The four-man comedy troupe met in a radio studio.
Turns out we were all fire signs. And we began improvising together on that show, on that night, and discovered that we all had something in common. We loved the Goon Shows, a very surrealistic BBC radio series. I was also a great fan of Bob and Ray and Ernie Kovacs, other great surrealists. And so we started improvising together on the radio, live, at late at night, and we discovered that we had this tremendous synergy.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0423 was Lauren Wolf, who is a faithful listener to the Stuff File program here in Montreal and a major fan of Gilligan's Island. Thank you very much, Lauren, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Firefighters in a German city said it took about 3 hours to free a man who had a very sensitive part of the body stuck in the center hole of a dumbbell weight. The Worms Fire Department said in a Facebook post that firefighters responded to a hospital in the appropriately named city of Worms after a man at a local gym ended up with a dumbbell disc stuck around his penis. The firefighters said it took them about 3 hours to break through the 5.5-pound weight using tools including a grinder and a hydraulic saw. The post included a photo of the dumbbell weight broken into 5 pieces. Please do not imitate such actions, the Facebook post said. So, a dumbbell basically found a new way to use a dumbbell. 3 hours, huh? That's how long the fire department was working on his member. Which means he was stuck in that thing even much longer if you consider the initial incident, then going to the hospital, then the fire department showing up. Oh, you know somewhere along this chain of events and hours of time that someone took a picture. And you know, in weightlifting, there is a procedure called clean and jerk, but trust me, this isn't it. Okay, 2 days after Hurricane Irma passed through Jacksonville, Florida, a police officer was dispatched to a report of someone loading a streetlight pole onto the top of their SUV. As he headed to the area, he noticed a light pole was missing from a bridge. Then he spotted the SUV. Strapped to the roof was a light pole that was significantly longer than the SUV. He stopped the men, who claimed they picked it up because it was close to traffic. 46-year-old Victor Walter Apler and 42-year-old Blake Lee Waller were arrested and charged with grand theft. The pole cost about $2,500. Investigators found Apler had sold 72 scrap metal items to recyclers this year alone. Well, you know, the metal in those handcuffs are easily worth $2. Just letting you know, Walter. Just letting you know. Here's another Irma-related story, by the way. Claire Connolly left her home in New Jersey to go to college in Florida. Then came Hurricane Irma. Fortunately, Connolly was able to get a flight home, but it was via Michigan. And the drive to the airport was 6 hours. Eventually, she landed in Newark and made her way to a suburban train and spent the ride studying. Then she woke up. "I was screaming at the top of my lungs for help," she says. "No one answered. The train was completely empty and shut down for the night. It hadn't even been the right train. Not only had the conductor not noticed she was on the train when it was shut down, someone had failed to notice her ticket was for another line. She called police, who rescued her, but blamed her for being irresponsible." Okay, tell me again who was irresponsible in this story. The tired, long-travel student, or the folks who never bothered to show her to the right train or later check to see if the train was empty? Yeah, I have a feeling this story isn't over. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a man in Peoria, Illinois, reported to police that someone broke into his home. Nothing was taken, but his trombone was damaged. The mouthpiece, in particular, was pounded harshly. Not wanting to have his name and address used, the local newspaper agreed to call him Sam. The 52-year-old newcomer to town, perplexed by the break-in, says he first played the trombone in middle school and had taken it up again recently, mostly playing church music, he says, recently trying to perfect "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." But he had to stop playing when someone assaulted his instrument. "Who does this?" Sam grumbled. Well, I don't want to go out on a limb, Sam, but I'm guessing a neighbor who isn't a friend of Jesus, or more importantly, you're playing. You want to be a real hit in the neighborhood, Sam? Try playing "What a Friend We Have in Jesus" on the bagpipes next. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The Cassini space probe's 20-year mission to Saturn came to an end in the middle of September with a fiery controlled crash into the ringed planet. This is one of NASA's most successful missions. What did Cassini discover, and what does this now mean for the future exploration of Saturn? To talk about this, we check in with science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. He joins us via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Well, good evening, Peter.
Nice to have you on the program once again, sir. I guess I'm assuming with all the coverage, especially you can see it on the NASA website, with all the coverage that was going on about Cassini's demise, you must have been watching it in complete rapture.
It's amazing. My own journalist career tracked the Cassini mission. I remember writing those first stories of when it arrived back in 2004. And when I was just starting out, and it's amazing now I've just witnessed the end of this mission.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. First of all, because we've discussed this in the past with other missions that have taken place, what was the time frame for the original mission? It wasn't 20 years.
No. I mean, the whole idea with many planetary missions, just like the Cassini mission, is that you go in and you get the basic science done as quickly as possible. The longer that a spacecraft hangs around, especially the large planets like Jupiter and Saturn, they're exposed to a lot of radiation from the planet, very extreme magnetic fields, and these can wreak havoc on the circuit boards and the electronics of a spacecraft. So many of the times, scientists that are part of the team, they're hoping to rake in as much science as possible within the first few months or the first couple of years in the mission. And it turns out that Cassini's mission was extended multiple times. It's just like an Energizer bunny of spacecrafts. It just kept on going, and it was perfect in its work that it was doing. All the instruments performed flawlessly throughout its 13 years at Saturn.
Okay, so what exactly was its timetable, original timetable? First of all, how long did it take to get to Saturn?
Well, it was a very arduous journey for Cassini. I mean, it went through 7 years from launch to arrival. Back in 1997 was when it launched, and it went through a series of slingshot effects using the Earth and Venus in large loops that it did in the inner solar systems. Every time, the reason they would do this, and that every time it would swing by, say Venus, which it did twice, it would this would act as a slingshot effect for it to speed up the spacecraft and send it to Saturn.
Okay, so does that mean that it was initially planned that it would take 7 years to reach Saturn?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
This was all, and because if we would have used fuel on board, it would have just, you would have had most of the spacecraft being taken up by fuel just to be able to get there fast, and you wouldn't have enough science on board really making it worth the while. So by doing these loop-de-loops and slingshot effects using other planets, it takes longer, but you get to pack the spacecraft with more instruments, more science.
Okay, so 7 years to get to the planet. That's what they had planned. That's what happened. What did they anticipate was going to be the amount of time it would do whatever science it was supposed to do, circling, orbiting the planet of Saturn?
Well, the initial phase was, and I'm not exactly sure on the exact time frame, but you know, we're talking at least a couple of years of being able to gather data. Now, within the first time frame, the one of the most critical portions of the mission involved a lander. The Huygens lander, which was actually a contribution by the European Space Agency. And way back in 2004, very soon after its arrival, just as the spacecraft arrived at the Saturn system, the mothership, Cassini, let go of this lander spacecraft that landed onto the moon Titan. And Titan has been a great mystery for science for decades. We know this in a smog and shrouded moon of Saturn. It's the largest moon in the solar system, and we can't see the surface. So we sent a lander using parachutes to go through the thick atmosphere, and it was a success back in 2004. And that was one of the biggest milestones, one of the true things on their bucket list that they had to get done. And so they did that right off the bat when it arrived.
Okay, so 2 years was a planned mission. That stretched to what turned out to be 13 years. So you just already mentioned one aspect of a very important discovery or find in their mission. What were some of the other things that Cassini did over the last 13 years that you would consider refreshingly mind-boggling?
Well, I think, you know, definitely, you know, when you look at Saturn, you think about Saturn, you can't help but be mesmerized by its rings, those iconic rings that surround the gas giant. And Cassini allowed us to understand by passing close to the rings multiple times in its loop-de-loop orbits around Saturn, coming close to it to get really amazing photography, close-up imagery of this, of the rings, to find out what they're made of. And now we know that there's billions of these particles, some the size of a grain of sand, some is the size of a house, that make up the rings. And we know the origins. We have theories now of the origins. We know the composition of the rings. We think that the rings weren't there all the time. Cassini has showed us hints of this distant past explosion, this collision that happened with an ancient moon that pulverized this moon, an oncoming comet or a wayward asteroid smashed into this ancient moon, pulverized it, and sent the remnants in an orbit around the gas giant planet. And that may have happened hundreds of millions of years ago, and we see the remnant of that ancient collision today in that beautiful rings. And it also, Cassini is telling us that these rings are a transitory feature of the planet, meaning that they're not going to last forever. Eventually, the particles of the rings will fall in towards the atmosphere of Saturn and disappear. So you and I are very fortunate to live in an epoch where we see this beautiful, majestic rings around Saturn. And we learned this from Cassini. And this is just one of many things that has uncovered in its orbits for 13 years.
Two-pronged question. Why the control burn to crash land onto the planet? And I also understand that that crashed burn, or the actually was a scientific test as well, correct?
Well, definitely. I mean, the idea was to bring squeeze out as much science out of Cassini, even in its last seconds. And they could have let the spacecraft go wayward by itself, but the danger was that it once it runs out of fuel, which it was very close to doing, within a matter of the next month or two, it would have run out totally out of propellant. And this is very important for the spacecraft to be able to maneuver it and keep the spacecraft in a stable orbit and point its antenna towards Earth so we get the science. And that was in jeopardy now at this point. So they figured that they would get the best science by putting it into a deep burn right into the atmosphere and allow it to burn up. And this was also important because there's a chance that there were, the spacecraft may have been contaminated with earthly microbes. Believe it or not, even being in space for 20 years, there are theories that suggest that these microbes may have survived the trip, hitched the ride on Cassini. And this is important because if they allowed the spacecraft to lose control of the spacecraft, it could have crash landed on one of the moons of Saturn, like Titan or Enceladus, another small moon. These are moons that are now thought to have habitable environments. Mm-hmm. There may in fact be evidence of even current life, not just extinct life, but current life on these moons. So we didn't want to contaminate them, and so the best way to avoid that is to just burn the spacecraft up in the upper atmosphere of Saturn.
Okay, we have just about a minute to go, so let's see if you can answer this question. Now that Cassini is over, a 20-year mission, what does that mean for the future of exploration of Saturn? What's next, if anything?
Well, definitely at the news conference, the final news conference by the Cassini mission scientists, they said that, well, now they just opened up, so many more questions about Saturn that it's a must that they will return. I mean, it's not a question of if, but more of when. And already on the drawing boards, there are a number of proposals for follow-up missions to build on Cassini's legacy of all the science that it's opened up, primarily with the moon Titan going back to see, explore for potential for life on the other neighboring moon Enceladus, which we think may have an ocean under a layer of ice. So the potentials are awesome in terms of even looking for current life, microbial life on these moons. And this would, these proposed missions, which would launch in early next decade, could answer some of the most fundamental questions of humankind, of are we alone in the universe?
Plus the technology that would be on any new probe or new mission to Saturn would be exponentially much more superior to what went up in Cassini 20 years ago.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the Cassini, when it launched in 1997, had technology that was near that was basically from the late 1980s.
Right.
So you can imagine that leap forward that we could do with a future mission.
Excellent. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir. How can people find you?
Oh, they can visit me on my Facebook page, The Night Sky Guy. I invite people to follow me there. And of course, on my weekly blog that I write at nationalgeographic.com. They can find my Starstruck column right there.
Thanks once again, sir, for being on the program.
My pleasure, and clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, The Night Sky Guy, and author of Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0423, and you'll find links to Andrew's site, plus links to amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the women of Walt Disney's animation. Plus, we'll meet one of the co-founders of the Fire Sign Theater. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way. And much more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, 18-year-old Connor Jurina of Caledonia, Wisconsin, allegedly admitted to police that he was blank-out drunk and broke into a neighbor's car intent on stealing something he saw inside, a fidget spinner. He woke up later with the spinner, American Eagle body spray, flip-flops, a pair of shoes, a vape device, and two bottles of booze. Connor doesn't remember much else, he told police, except that he also found a prescription bottle in the car and thought to himself, "Oh, dude, pills!" and took them. Wow. Which is exactly why science needs to develop a true smart pill, because some obliviates will eventually accidentally take some of those, too. I mean, what a moron. I would have made him idiot of the day, but I have no way of gauging how inebriated he was when stupidity finally took over. So, but we will have an idiot of the day coming up a little later on. Meanwhile, a North Carolina man and his uncle had a hell of a good time this past Tuesday evening when they allegedly enjoyed some brewskis while watching a lawnmower and vehicle burn in their front yard, shot at passing vehicles, and later setting their house ablaze. The Airedale County Sheriff's Office stated the incident happened at the home of 62-year-old Jimmy Carson Messer. Cops were alerted by a passing driver who called in to report that Messer and his nephew, 30-year-old Bobby Lee Messer Jr., had fired a gun at them. Cops arrived on scene to find the two Messers on their front lawn, pounding back some beer while watching a vehicle and a lawnmower engulfed in flames. Jimmy allegedly told cops he had a gun in his pocket. Both men were arrested by police, but Jimmy slipped out of his handcuffs. That's when the cops shot him with a stun gun. Bobby was charged with two counts of assault with a deadly weapon, while his uncle Jimmy faces charges of resisting, obstructing, or delaying the investigation. He was released on $5,000 bail. Upon his release, the elder Messer returned home to set it on fire. Injured during the fire, he was transported to a hospital for treatment. Now, I posted their mugshots on the Stuff File program Facebook page so that you can enjoy the look of ignorance they share, particularly the younger Messer. And again, these are some guys I could have easily named Idiot of the Week, but once again, alcohol played a major role in this story, and we usually like our idiots to be stone cold sober. So, there you go. Anyway, let's get to our last story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The Sheridan Caudwell Orchestras, a 26-year-old organization that provides live music entertainment for weddings, corporate functions, and such in Toronto, sent an email to its volunteers advising that only singers who are physically fit and slim, or at the very least, those who know how to dress strategically, suitably, in order to not bring attention to their temporary physical dietary indulgences, would be showcased with our boutique orchestras. Now, those playing instruments need not worry, however, the email continued, since they are essentially background wallpaper. A massive outpour followed, the troupe's board resigned, and the entire organization has shut down. So, I guess it's over, huh? Well, I guess the fat lady has sung. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mindy Johnson is an award-winning author and historian. She has brought the world of early animation and cinema to the masses through books and speaking engagements. Her latest book is Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. Mindy joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Mindy.
Hi, Peter. So great to be here.
Lovely to have you on the program. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of people who weren't even aware of the fact that there were women in the early days of animation. That might sound like a sexist remark, but I'm glad you have brought them to the forefront with your book.
Well, it is true. A lot of people are surprised, and myself included, because really when you look at what we have known about animation history, it's mostly men. So it was a real joy to sort of really do some deep digging and find and make some extraordinary discoveries that women, in fact, have been there from the very beginning and have been a large part of the extraordinary world of animation. It's just that we've never really known that what they've done until now.
Now, what are we talking about in terms of numbers? Were there a few women in animation back then? Were there a lot of women in animation who didn't get the recognition? What are we talking about?
Well, it depends largely on the time frame, but both are true. Very early on, there were women exploring animation, going back to 1916 at the earliest with Helena Smith Dayton, who was a writer and began sculpting with clay, creating these very whimsical characters, and soon met up with a filmmaker at around 1915, and they began to discuss this idea of combining this early burgeoning industry of film, an art form of film, with her sculptures and finding ways to make them move and bend and animate them. She went on to make about three or four, possibly five films. Sadly, they, at least as far as we know today, they do not exist. We're still hoping to find them. But then World War I came along, and she went off to serve in the Volunteer Red Cross and returned back a sort of a changed person and ended up moving on to other art forms. But she was a real pioneer in early claymation and stop-motion animation. But now, women have been involved from the very beginning.
Well, you've gone back to 1916 in your book, Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. What time frame are we going from? From the earliest days, I'm assuming, up until when?
Well, I take you back actually to the beginning of celluloid, because it was women who were largely responsible for the hand colorization of the earliest silent films. This was a practice that was deemed appropriate for women stemming out of the textile industries. And these women would sit with paintbrushes with a single hair and dot the rouge on a cheek of each frame of film so that there was a sense of color about the characters as you saw the silent films unfold. But the book spans about 100 years and takes you up to 1990 and the advent of the computer animation production systems. So it really was women at the forefront of so many of the various technologies that evolved the art form of animation.
You talk about that celluloid situation going back to the early days of silent films. It almost sounds like they were the early version of an aftermarket makeup artist.
I mean, pretty much. When you look at some of the early the Georges Méliès films and the early Edisons, audiences from the very beginning, color was always there, and audiences demanded it. They were enthralled with this moving image industry, but our world is a vivid, colorful world, and so we want to see that as well when we're looking at films. So very early on, with hand-tinted and hand-colored films, they were expensive and time-consuming, but audiences responded to them. So color has always been a part of our film history, and it's largely been women applying that color. And so it was a natural offshoot then as animation evolved. In fact, people are a little surprised to learn that that was largely men at the beginning. But women soon were entered into it, and often at other studios it was men and women who were doing what they called blackening in the drawing so that they could be read on camera. And then as celluloid was introduced and paints were introduced, it was black and white paints and about three or four shades of gray. And then with the advent of color, which began at Disney Studios with the three-strip Technicolor process, it was women at the forefront of that. And their work garnered the very first Academy Award for animated films.
Wow. Now, going back to 1916, obviously you didn't have any opportunity to talk to any of the women who worked back then, but
yes.
in the latter days, when things were happening at Disney, which is the focus of your book, did you get to talk to any of the people who were around at that time who worked in that situation?
I sure did, and that's one of the biggest joys of this volume. It's told in as many firsthand accounts as possible. And so the ladies really are telling their story and experiences. And thankfully, through a few very wise researchers early in the last maybe 20 years, I was able to get oral histories from a handful of early women who had worked in the very beginning of animation and some of the earlier studios. But then I was able to work with women such as Ruthie Thompson, who just turned this past July 107 years old. And Ruthie is the only living person who was inside Walton Roy's Kingswell storefront studio as a young girl.
Wow.
And she then started in the mid-1930s as a young painter and painted on Snow White and virtually every film leading into the 1970s, I believe, late 1980, I believe, is when she retired. And Ruthie's also unique in that she was one of the first women to be brought into the camera union. She worked during the war sort of as a Rosie the Riveter. Many of the women stepped into various roles during World War II that the men held, and then when the men returned, they went back to their roles, but they enjoyed what they did. They also got the pay that they had, that the men were getting, and they liked that as well. So in time, they were at the forefront of making change, and Walt was very supportive. It was a really great discovery to learn. He was quite progressive and very supportive and worked to advance women in different roles within animation.
I was just about to ask you, obviously your book appreciates what these women did, but were they appreciated at the time?
Well, yes and no. I think in many ways, the animators certainly, many of them spoke about recognizing the artistry of what the women contributed with in terms of color and their work in animation as animators, in-betweeners and cleanup artists. But again, society is sort of geared in a bit more of a male direction. And the very word history is, in fact, his story. And history has a way of being recorded, preserved, archived, documented, and written about from a male perspective. So it really sort of put me on a bit of an odyssey to find many of these women who are still with us and their families, the children of many of these women who came to me with banker's boxes filled with journals and albums and artwork to saying, please tell our mother's story. It literally was digging in closets and under beds to find artwork and culling together. I did over 120 some odd interviews for this book, and it's really never before heard, never before told stories behind some of the most beloved and classic animated stories that we all know and cherish.
It sounds like you're not only a historian, but a bit of an archaeologist as well.
Exactly. Many of these pieces, as you can imagine, a lot of it had sort of scattered to the winds. So in unearthing a piece of paper, a document in someone's home answered a question that no one knew about, would unlock the mystery. We found that the Disney Studios has an extraordinary archives, and I was so eager to get in to find any material, but there was plenty on certain films and quite a bit on many of the men, but when we went to find any material preserved for the ink and paint departments or the women artists beyond ink and paint, sadly, there was a folder with about maybe five pieces of paper. So we had to think differently in terms of how, where we could find the information we'd hoped to find. And in some cases, it worked. In other cases, we had to, go back to some of the family members to see if we could continue to find material. But all in all, it was an extraordinary puzzle, but pieced together in such a way that I've been referring to it as fine Swiss cheese. There are a few bits of holes here and there, but perhaps now that this is written and by putting a call out, not only in the book, but in the interviews I'm giving, to let those families or people, women who worked in animation prior to the 1970s, to please reach out, and because the research does continue. And I'm, in fact, just unearthed some information on a female animator in Iowa, of all places, in the 1920s. So I've got a lot of research to do.
The book is called Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. Not only is it an important chronicle of what the women did in the early days of working in animation, but it also fleshes out a little bit how complex animation itself really is. So it's another reason that to check out the book. Mindy, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, Peter, a joy. Thank you so much.
Mindy Johnson, author of Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0423, and you'll find links to Mindy's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It probably wouldn't surprise you to hear that Harvard Law School has produced almost twice as many U.S. Supreme Court justices as any other law school. Its reputation for training brilliant lawyers is well known, so when I visited Harvard recently, I made it a point to tour its law library. Located just north of historic Harvard Yard, the library contains statues and tributes to some of its most distinguished alumni, and I was happy to see that one of them honors my favorite judge, Learned Hand. That's right, his name was Learned Hand, and what an appropriate name it was. He was a respected federal judge, and while he never served on the Supreme Court, his opinions have been quoted more often in Supreme Court opinions than those of any other lower court judge. Let's be fair, that's certainly praiseworthy, but he's my favorite judge because he once said, and I quote, "Litigation is to be dreaded beyond almost anything short of sickness or death," unquote. A smart man indeed. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And we're in the twilight of this episode of The Stuff File program. We do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and we will speak to Phil Proctor, co-founder of the Fire Sign Theater and the author of Where's My Fortune Cookie? We don't have time for another Stuff File news story, but I do have a moment to do a couple of quick things here. One of them is to plug my book. yes. My new book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and more, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Check it out. It's available at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website, which is BearManorMedia.com. You'll find all the links to find the book on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? And the other item I want to do here before we get to our next guest is to fulfill a request. Among the many places that this show is heard, one of them is WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's the place you'll find our old friend Tony Whitehill. Those who know Tony are aware that he has a secret love, a deep-rooted secret love for Disco Duck. Now, while I can't play the whole song, I can hope to quench his appetite a little bit with a snippet from Rick Dees and his cast of idiots.
Went to a party the other night. All the ladies were treating me right. Moving my feet to the disco beat. How in the world could I keep my seat?
Tony, just a taste of Rick Dees and Disco Duck. Don't ever say I never did anything for you. Let's get to our next guest on the program, shall we? Phil Proctor, the co-founder of the legendary surrealist comedy group, The Fire Sign Theater, has just released his autobiography. It's called Where's My Fortune Cookie? My Psychic Surrealistic Story. Phil joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Phil.
Hi there, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Sure. I have nothing but time, and I'm so glad I do because I'm 77 years old.
There you go. Now, for people who might be a little bit dyslexic trying to find your book, we've got to quantify the spelling of the subtitle of your book, My Psychic Surrealistic Story. You start all those words with P.S.
That's right. P.S. That's the way you should look for it. But no, I think if you just Google, you know, Where's My Fortune Cookie, you'll find it, because I don't believe anybody else has come up with a title like that, and certainly nobody has lived through the experience of surviving a Chinese gangland shooting in San Francisco in 1977, which is the reason for the title. So I don't think you'll have any trouble finding it. Phil Proctor, my name is, it's enough to be able to Google the various things you're doing, but I have to warn you, the book will not be available on Amazon until the 28th of this month, which coincides with a performance that I am doing with the last surviving member of the Firesign Theater, my dear partner David Osman, at the Coolidge Theater in the Library of Congress in Washington, A.C., D.C.
Now, I did an overnight radio show for 20 years here in Montreal, and one of the things we used to do was a comedy hour in the wee hours of the morning, and your albums were some of the favorites that were often requested by those who listened to the show. So I never got a chance to talk to you back when I was doing that program. I was curious to know, just how did the Fire Sign Theater start up?
The fact is, it's in the book, But the fact is that I went to school with Peter Bergman, Yale University, and I did several musicals. I starred in Tom Jones, the musical before the movie, and I starred in another musical about the Booth family, Junius Brutus Booth and his family, called Booth is Back in Town. With Peter Bergman, he wrote the lyrics for those. So I knew Peter from Yale. Many, many years later, after appearing in a play, a musical comedy that I won a Theatre World Award for, called The Amorous Flea, which was in California, in Los Angeles, California, I went back to do another Broadway show another Broadway show after that, and then ended up traveling to California with Brandon DeWilda, who was the boy, you know, Shane, come back, Shane, and became a close friend of mine because I understudied him in a play. Well, we connected up with Peter Fonda, don't ask why, and we ended up at the Sunset Strip riots. It's in the book. And during the Sunset Strip riots, I sat down on an open copy of the L.A. Free Press on a picture of Peter Bergman. I sat down on Peter Bergman's face, and I picked it up, and it said, KPFK newsman Peter Bergman is interviewing returning Vietnam War veterans. I went, Peter Bergman, I went to Yale with him. So I called him up the next day after, Peter Fonda was arrested, Brandon was beaten up, I was writing for the East Village Other at the time, so I held up my press card. Press, press, I said. And they all pressed around me, the police, and didn't bother me. So I called Peter up the next day. He says, yes, I'm the Wizard of Oz. So what are you talking about? It turns out he had created a show called Radio Free Oz on KPFK, a listener-supported station off of Ventura Boulevard in Los Angeles. And he said, why don't you come down and play with me? So I said, fine, I will. So I came down to the show that night. It was a counterculture call-in talk show in 1965, 66, whenever this was. It's in the book. I have to read the book to find out. And I was introduced to David Osman and to Phil Austin. Phil Austin was producing his show, and David Osman was working at KPFK. We turned out we were all fire signs. I'm a Leo, Peter's a Sagittarian, David's a Sagittarian, Phil is an Aries. And we began improvising together on that show, on that night, and discovered that we all had something in common. We loved the Goon Shows, a very surrealistic BBC radio series starring Spike Milligan, the memorable people, and Peter Sellers, among others. And it had inspired us all. I was also a great fan of Bob and Ray and Ernie Kovacs, other great surrealists. And so we started improvising together on the radio live at late at night, and we discovered that we had this tremendous synergy. We were like jazz musicians jamming for the first time. And as it evolved, we got an opportunity to do records at Columbia Records. And we put out our first record, Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him, which had a moderate success. But then one of the producers there named John McClure said, you can't drop these guys. They're geniuses. They're revolutionizing comedy. Well, I'm going to put them under a spoken arts contract. That meant that we had unlimited free studio time. So since we were our own producers and our own cast and our own writers, we could go in, write. We could write something, go in, record it, listen to it, go back, write some more, go in, record it, overdub it, record it, reject it, go back, write some more. We had this wonderful opportunity to play in this electronic playground there in Hollywood and create multi-layered comedy albums, which we did. The story of it and it's, you know, all of the people who came to help us and all of the wonderful, strange psychedelic and kind of psychic things that happened to make the Firesign Theater's career evolve is in the book. I can't obviously talk about it in this short time, but we had a great career success. And by the time we did our third album, after our second album, which by the way was called How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Not Anywhere at All, which is exactly where we are now, by the way, also known as the Marx Lennon album, which also had Nick Danger, Third Eye, on the second side, because we were going to do that as a radio serial until we were fired from the show we were doing. And we said, what are we going to do with this? Let's put it on the record. And that became really our most accessible album, because it was a parody of detective noir dramas. So suddenly, we were very famous were starting to become famous, and then we did Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, which predicted channel surfing, basically, and that's the album that brought us to national attention and is also the album that was inducted into the Library of Congress as an hysterical or historical recording, along with Jimi Hendrix's catalog and Martha and the Vandellas. And we had a wonderful luncheon there and a tour of the place. And on the 28th of September, we're playing to a sold-out crowd at the Library of Congress in the Coolidge Theater in Washington, AC/DC, with me and David Osman, which is basically the Firesign Theater, or what's left of it, because we lost both Peter Bergman and Phil Austin, five years ago and 2 years ago. Very tragic. But David and I are carrying on the mantra of the Firesign Theater. And as you can see, because I keep mixing up the names, we embody everybody else. Because in our writing, which we call the 4 or 5 Crazy Guys, we would often lose track of who came up with what idea. It was like we were sitting around a witch's cauldron and throwing, you know, the eye of Newt and the foot of Trump into it and mixing it all together. And ultimately, what we came up with was a melange and a wonderful potpourri of everything that we were all contributing to the story that we were telling. So I embody Peter and Phil, as does David, and the piece that we're doing, which is called The Art of the History of Radio, is a piece that we did many, many years ago for a public broadcast system in a special broadcast that they did in the 70s, and we're reinventing it and modernizing it for a present audience. And then we'll be showing some excerpts from our 2-DVD set, which is called Everything You Know Is Wrong, The Firesign Theater Declassified, available at www.firesidetheater.com, along with many other interesting projects that we are releasing to the public. And we're showing a home movie of the actual recording sessions of Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. And then we'll be doing a question and answer with the audience about our career, which is a 50-year career. It's unbelievable. And actually, it's kind of limping on with David and me. So we're still creating a crazy kind of surrealistic comedy.
It sounds like it tells
some of these stories, but also the strange psychic trail that led me to find the fire sign and to basically mix my own career in television and film and other voiceover media, books on tape, and all of that with my partners.
It sounds like you guys had a great time putting the albums together. I remember listening to those and hearing how, for lack of a better term, how frenetic they were. And it just seems like the comedy came bursting out of you guys. Now, having talked to you, and we've chatted already for 10 minutes and we're just about out of time, having talked to you in this short interview, the thing I noticed is it sounds like you truly did love every single minute of what you did during your career, and you're still enjoying it. Would that be correct?
À vrai dire, mon vieux, there were also divorces, fights, and all kinds unalliances that happened. You know, we had all kinds of artistic differences, but the underlying love, as you expressed, of what we could create together is what brought us together again, what kept us together, and what I hope our audiences still receive when they listen to our material.
Again, the book is called Where's My Fortune Cookie? My Psychic Surrealistic Story. And people can find out more information by going to your website. That is planetproctor.com. Also find that information about your upcoming show as well. Phil, I thank you very, very much. It's been an honor and a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you.
Merci beaucoup, également. À la prochaine, hein?
Phil Proctor, co-founder of the Fire Sign Theater and the author of Where's My Fortune Cookie? My Psychic Surrealistic Story. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0423, and you'll find links to Phil's site, plus links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. And Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, as a Patreon reward, you can hear more of Phil, since, as you just heard, he has rather a lot to say. He's pretty chatty. Just go to our Patreon page and become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. And we thank you for your patronage. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A Canadian man has pleaded guilty to trafficking drugs after he shoved 8 Kinder eggs containing cannabis and MDMA up his rectum, then threw a rock at police so he could sell the contraband to prisoners for large profits. 20-year-old Damien O'Reilly put 59 grams of marijuana and 1 gram of MDMA into 8 Kinder Surprise plastic inner eggs. He then managed to push them all up his butt. With part one of his plan complete, O'Reilly needed to get inside a jail, where drugs can be sold to prisoners at around 10 times the street value. With this in mind, he threw a rock at a police car parked in front of an Ottawa courthouse. He was immediately arrested and taken to Ottawa Carlton Detention Center. However, once inside the notorious jail, things began to unravel. Prison guards became suspicious that he was smuggling drugs, possibly because O'Reilly, who now had 8 Kinder eggs inside of him for several hours, was in some discomfort. In any case, he was sent to a dry cell with no flushing toilet or running water, designed for the exact purpose of letting illicit items make their way through a person's digestive system. Seeing that the game was up, O'Reilly took the eggs out of himself and handed them over to the guards. In addition to the drugs, they contained tobacco, rolling papers, and some matches. Think about that. Matches that close to a source of methane. Wow. Anyway, O'Reilly pleaded guilty to drug trafficking and was sentenced to 2 years in prison. He has already served 250 days as the unlikely chain of events took place in June of 2016. Now, why, oh why, would you think sneaking drugs up your behind into a prison would be a good thing to do? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0423. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0423. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.